Hello and welcome to In the News on Chris. I'm Rick Anderson, and today I'll be reading selected stories from the New York Times edition of the Science section on April 10, 2024. Our first story, in which we balance all of the wonderful things that have happened about this week's eclipse, starts out with, "Someday, Earth will have a final total solar eclipse. The moon will drift far enough away from Earth that it will no longer fully obstruct the sun." But predicting when this will happen poses numerous challenges. The story is by Catherine Cornell. The total solar eclipse, visible on Monday over parts of Mexico, the United States, and Canada, was a perfect confluence of the sun and moon in the sky. But it's also the kind of event that comes with an expiration date. At some point in the distant future, Earth will experience its last total solar eclipse. That's because the moon is drifting away from the Earth. So our nearest celestial neighbor will one day, millions or even billions of years in the future, will appear too small in the sky to completely obscure the sun. We'll only ever have annular eclipses, said Noah Petro, a planetary scientist at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, referring to the Ring of Fire eclipses like the one that crossed America in October. But putting an exact date on Earth's final total solar eclipse is a serious computational challenge involving a variety of scientific disciplines. Ever since the moon formed over 4 billion years ago, it has been spiraling away from Earth. The moon's retreat results from its gravitational interactions with our planet. Tides raised by that gravity send the water in our planet's oceans sliding over the seafloor and along the edges of continents. That creates friction that causes Earth to spin more slowly on its axis, said Matthias Green, an ocean scientist at Bangor University of Wales. The moon moves outward in its orbit in response to the slowing of the Earth. Imagine a figure skater extending her arms and slowing down, Dr. Green said. It's the same physical principle, but backwards. One of the first people to predict the expanding orbit of the moon was George Darwin, one of Charles Darwin's sons. But his hypothesis, published in 1879, would not be verified until American astronauts and Soviet robotic rovers left devices known as retroreflectors on the moon's surface. Researchers could fire laser pulses at mirrors on those suitcase-sized instruments and time how long it took the light to make the round trip. That gave scientists a way of precisely measuring the distance to the moon. By the early 1970s, researchers had found that the moon was receding from Earth by about 1.5 inches per year. That's about the rate at which human fingernails grow. We're dealing with extremely small changes, said Robert Tyler, a planetary scientist at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. But over hundreds of millions of years, the moon will become perceptibly smaller in the sky as it grows more distance. At some point, it will appear to be too small to completely blot out the sun, and total solar eclipses will become a thing of the past. To calculate the date of the last total solar eclipse, it is important to remember that both the moon's orbit around the Earth and the Earth's orbit around the sun are elliptical. That means that the distances between the Earth and moon and between Earth and sun are not constant. The apparent sizes of the moon and the sun, as seen from Earth, vary accordingly. The largest and smallest looking moons differ in size by about 14%, while the corresponding difference from the sun is about 3%. The last total solar eclipse will occur when the largest looking moon just barely covers the smallest looking sun. A bit of math involving the diameter of the moon and the apparent sizes of the moon and the sun yields an estimate for that eventuality at approximately 620 million years. But there is uncertainty in that number, researchers caution. It is assumed, for starters, that the moon will recede from Earth at its current rate, and that almost certainly won't happen, Dr. Green said. The moon's recession rate is affected by a slew of parameters, he said, including the length of a day on Earth, the depth of the ocean basins, and the arrangements of our continents. These things change over time, Dr. Green said, so it is too simplistic to presume that the moon will always retreat at the same pace. Most researchers agree that the moon's recession rate will probably decrease. If I had to guess, the tides of the future will probably get weaker, said Brian Arbic, a physical oceanographer at the University of Michigan. Weaker tides translate into slower lunar retreat, which would buy our planet more opportunities to bask in the moon's umbral shadow. There's good evidence that the moon retreated more slowly in the past as well. Marguerite Bing-Lentink, a geologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, has analyzed sedimentary rocks in Australia that record climate changes caused by fluctuations in the Earth-Moon distance. I read the fingerprints of these astronomical variations, Dr. Lentink said. Team's finding and those of other researchers have been used in simulations that suggest the moon receded by almost 0.4 to 1.2 inches per year for much of its history. Those simulations reveal that during some periods lasting a few tens of millions of years, the moon hurtled away from Earth at more than 4 inches per year. Dr. Tyler's models take on the daunting task of forecasting the future lunar recession rate. They suggest that the moon will drift away at about 0.3 inches per year on average for the next several billion years. And the moon's retreat in the future won't be nearly as variable as it was in the ancient past, he said. Most of the interesting stuff happened already. If Dr. Tyler's simulations are correct, total eclipses will remain visible for about 3 billion years. He cautioned that there is a significant uncertainty in that estimate. And though we likely have eons left to experience total eclipses, there's no excuse for not seeking out their splendor, Dr. Petro said. After all, they're a celestial phenomenon that's unique to our earthly existence. No other planet in our solar system has total solar eclipses, Dr. Petro said. We have this wonderful opportunity. And let's turn now to something more earthbound, where it says, large scientific review confirms the benefits of physical touch. Premature babies especially benefited from skin-to-skin contact, and women tended to respond more strongly than men did. The story is by Joanne Silberner. A hug, a handshake, a therapeutic message, a newborn lying on a mother's bare chest. Physical touch can buoy well-being and lessen pain, depression, and anxiety, according to a large new analysis of published research released recently in the journal Nature Human Behavior. Researchers from Germany and the Netherlands systematically reviewed years of research on touch, strokes, hugs, and rubs. They also combined data from 137 studies, which included nearly 13,000 adults, children, and infants. Each study compared individuals who had been physically touched in some way over the course of an experiment, or had touched an object like a fuzzy stuffed toy, to similar individuals who had not. For example, one study showed that daily 20-minute gentle massages for 6 weeks in older people with dementia decreased aggressiveness and reduced the levels of a stress marker in the blood. Another found that massages boosted the mood of breast cancer patients. One study even showed that healthy young adults who caressed a robotic baby seal were happier and felt less pain from a mild heat stimulus than those who read an article about an astronomer. Positive effects were particularly noticeable in premature babies who massively improved with skin-to-skin contact, said Frederick Michon, a researcher at the Netherlands Institute for Neuroscience and one of the study's authors. There have been a lot of claims that touch is good, touch is healthy, touch is something that we all need, said Rebecca Boheim, a neuroscientist at Linköping University in Sweden, who reviewed the study for the journal. But actually, nobody looked at it from this broad bird's eye perspective. The analysis revealed some interesting and sometimes mysterious patterns. Among adults, sick people showed greater mental health benefits from touch than healthy people did. Who was doing the touching, a familiar person or a healthcare worker, didn't matter. The source of the touch did matter to newborns. One very intriguing finding that needs further support is that newborn babies benefit more from their parents' touch than from a stranger's touch, said Via Harjunen, a researcher at the University of Helsinki in Finland, who also reviewed the study for the journal. Babies' preference for their parents could be related to smell, he speculated, or to the differences in the way parents hold them. Women seem to benefit more from touch than men, which may be a cultural effect, Dr. Michon said. Frequency of the touch also mattered. A massage once every 2 years isn't going to do much. Several studies included in the review looked at what happened during the height of the COVID pandemic when people were isolated and had less physical contact with others. They found correlations during COVID times between touch deprivation and health aspects like depression and anxiety, Dr. Michon said. Touching the head appears to have more of a beneficial effect than touching the torso, some studies found. Dr. Michon couldn't explain that finding, but thought it could have to do with the greater number of nerve endings on the face and scalp. Another mystery, studies of people in South America tended to show stronger health benefits of touch than did those studies and looked at people in North America or Europe. Dr. Michon said that culture may somehow play a role, but Dr. Bohim said that the studies showed the differences between countries were too small to be definitive. I think the mechanism behind this is biological, she said. I think that's hardwired and will be the same for all of us. In 2023, Jeeva Sankar, a pediatrics researcher at All India Institute of Medical Sciences, and a colleague published a rigorous review of skin-to-skin care for newborns. The analysis concluded that touch therapy for preterm or low birth weight infants should start as soon as possible and last 8 hours or more, a recommendation that the World Health Organization adopted. Dr. Sankar said a new review was important because touch is often neglected in modern medical care, but it was too broad. He would have liked it to focus more on how various forms of touch could be integrated into medical care. Dr. Michon stressed that the types of touch considered in these studies were positive experiences to which the volunteers agreed. If someone doesn't feel a touch as being pleasant, it's going to stress them out, he said. Our next story is of special interest to folks in the local area who experienced a recent earthquake after effects. An article that says, will there be another earthquake? Well, here's the forecast for aftershocks. So far, seismologists have not identified any distinguishing way that characteristics of a given quake that would warn of impending larger one. The story was by Kenneth Chang. Will the ground around White House Station, New Jersey, continue to shake in the coming days? Almost certainly. Indeed, several aftershocks have already occurred. The latest at 5:59 Eastern Time, and this is on April 5th, according to the United States Geological Survey, occurred near Gladstone, New Jersey, and had a preliminary magnitude of 4.0 and was reportedly felt all around the region. Earlier aftershocks were around magnitude 2.0, barely perceptible even to people standing right at the epicenter. Larger aftershocks are also possible. The USGA suggests a 45% chance of an aftershock of magnitude 3 or larger in this next week. The odds rise to about 66% over the next year. Is this a precursor to a devastating quake? Maybe, but unlikely. Major earthquakes of magnitude 7 or higher are often preceded by modest foreshocks. But so far, seismologists have not identified any distinguishing characteristics of a given shake that would warn of an impending larger quake. If a devastating quake were to occur, seismologists would retroactively call Friday's shaking a foreshock, but they have no way to confidently predict a large quake ahead of time. Seismologists know that large earthquakes in this part of the world are rare. A study by scientists at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University in 2008 found that a magnitude 5 earthquake occurs in the New York City region about once a century, a magnitude 6 or larger about once every 670 years, and a magnitude 7 at once about every 3,400 years. That is reflected in the Geological Survey's aftershock forecast, which currently says that there is less than a 1% chance that Friday's quake will be followed by a magnitude 6 quake or larger. Even the chance of a comparable earthquake of magnitude 5 is only 3% over the next week and 8% over the next year. Now, this forecast will be updated as the instruments measure new seismic data. That's the end of the article as it was written, and your reader notices that there have been no significant earthquakes since then. And we now turn to a story that says ancient foxes lived and died alongside humans. Extinct foxes and other animals were an important part of an early South American community, a new study has found. Story is by Jack Tamasea. When roving bands of hunter-gatherers domesticated the wolves, scavenging their scraps at the end of the Pleistocene era, they set the stage for the tail-wagging, puppy-eyed canines we know and love today. But dogs were not the only ancient canines to become companions. Archaeologists have found traces of foxes living among early communities throughout South America. This includes the nearly complete skeleton of an extinct fox discovered in northwestern Patagonia. A team of researchers recently examined the fox's bones, which were unearthed among the remains of dozens of hunter-gatherers. The team's findings, published recently in the journal Royal Society Open Science, posit that this fox lived alongside the humans it was buried with. It appears to have been intentionally buried within this human cemetery, said Ophélie Lebrasseur, a zooarchaeologist at the University of Oxford and an author of the new study. It's a practice that has long been suggested before, but to actually find it is a nice surprise. According to Dr. Lebrasseur, most archaeological traces of South American canids are usually isolated bones or teeth, but the nearly complete skeleton of a fox-like animal was discovered when archaeologists excavated the Canada Sica burial site in central Argentina in 1991. The site, which was accidentally unearthed by local clay miners, also contained the bones of at least 24 human individuals and artifacts like beads, lip ornaments, and spear points. Analysis of the site's human bones revealed that these people lived roughly 1,500 years ago and practiced a nomadic lifestyle. The Canada Sica canid skeleton was initially identified as a Lyca lopex, a group of still-living fox-like canids, but closer examination of the creature's teeth revealed that it was more likely to be the extinct Dusician avis, or D. avis, a medium-sized fox that weighed as much as a small sheepdog and resembled a jackal. D. avis inhabited grasslands across a large swath of Patagonia from the late Ice Age until around 500 years ago. It was closely related to the Falkland Islands wolf, which was hunted to extinction in 1876. Dr. Lebrasseur teamed up with Cynthia Albonia, a biologist at Institut Evolution Historical Ecology and Environment and in Argentina, and several other researchers to conclusively prove the identity of this skeleton. They ground down samples of the animal's forearm and vertebrae, which they analyzed for snippets of ancient DNA. Although the ancient DNA was degraded, the team was still able to recreate some of the fox's genetic code. They compared it with the complete genomes from domestic dogs and extant South American canids, likely the closely related maned wolf. This strengthened the case that the animal buried at the Cañada Seca was D. avis, The genetic work also helped disprove the theory that these ancient foxes were doomed by hybridization. Some scientists speculate that when domestic dogs arrived in Patagonia around 900 years ago, they bred with foxes. This would have diluted the fox's gene pool and potentially created hybrid hounds capable of outcompeting purebred foxes. But Dr. Levasseur and her colleagues found that the extinct foxes were most likely too genetically distinct from domesticated dogs to produce fertile offspring. Instead, the growing influence of humans on the local environment and a changing climate may have played larger roles in the species' demise. Another mystery was why the fox's remains were interred at the Cañada Seca gravesite. The radiocarbon age of the fox's bones matched the ages of the site's human bones. The similar preservation of the two species' bones also hinted that they were buried around the same time. Additionally, the researchers examined isotopic signatures preserved in the fox's teeth. While most wild canids eat almost exclusively meat, a portion of the fox's diet was composed of maize-like plant material. This mirrors the amount of plant material that the humans buried at Cañada Seca were eating. The new finding adds to a growing body of evidence that foxes and other canids were important species of ancient South American communities. Ornaments fashioned from the teeth of fox-like cupeos adorn human remains at burial sites in Peru and Argentina. Archaeological deposits in Chile reveal that other canids were also part of the local diet. An animal that eats like humans and is buried like them must surely have had a close relationship with them, said Aurora Grandal Anglade, zooarchaeologist at the University of A Coruña in Spain, which was not involved in this study. This relationship between fox and ancient humans may have been developed through systematic feeding, and it's plausible that the foxes were used solely as companions, said Dr. Grandal Anglade, who has studied fox remains found in the Bronze Age deposits in the Iberian Peninsula. While it appeared this fox lived alongside the region's early hunter-gatherers, Dr. Levasseur said she would be hesitant to snuggle up with it on a couch. I think the animal was likely tamed, but not something you would consider an actual pet, she said. And we now turn to our final story, hopefully, or likely to be foreshortened. Ocean heat has shattered records for more than a year. What's happening? Well, there have been record temperatures every day for more than a year. Scientists are investigating what's behind the extraordinary measurements. The story is by Delger Erdesanana. The ocean has now broken temperature records every day for more than a year. And so far, 2024 has registered 2023's trend of beating previous records by wide margin. In fact, the whole planet has been hot for months, according to many different data sets. There's no ambiguity about the data, said Gavin Schmidt, a climatologist and the director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. So really, it's a question of attribution. Understanding what specific physical processes are behind these temperature records will help scientists improve their climate models and better predict temperatures in the future. Last month, the average global sea surface temperature reached a new monthly high of 21.07 degrees Celsius, or 69.93 degrees Fahrenheit, according to the Copernicus Climate Change Service, a research institution funded by the European Union. March 2024 continues the sequence of climate records toppling for both air temperature and ocean surface temperatures, Samantha Burgess, Deputy Director of Copernicus, said in a statement this week. The tropical Atlantic is abnormally warm, helping set the stage for a busy hurricane season, according to an early forecast by scientists at Colorado State University. Higher ocean temperatures provide more energy to fuel stronger storms. Global temperatures are rising long-term because the burning of fossil fuels adds greenhouse gases which warm the planet to the atmosphere. So far, climate change has raised the global average temperature by about 1.2 degrees Celsius, or 2.2 degrees Fahrenheit, above the pre-industrial average temperature. And because it takes more energy to heat up water than air, the oceans have absorbed the vast majority of the planet's warming from greenhouse gases. But the massive, massive records set over the past year are beyond what scientists would expect to see, even considering climate change, Dr. Schmidt said. What's different now compared with this time last year is that the planet is dealing with the effects of an El Niño event that began in July. El Niño events are natural climate patterns associated with elevated temperatures. Temperatures we're seeing now, the records being broken in February and March, are actually much more in line with what we would expect compared with those of last year, Dr. Schmidt said. Let's see what happens by the summer. El Niño is weakening and expected to dissipate soon. What happens to global temperatures would then help shed light on the temperatures of 2023, he said. In addition to climate change and El Niño, there are a couple of other factors that might be contributing to these dizzying records. One is a recent reduction in aerosol pollution from container ships traversing the ocean following new international fuel standards that took effect in 2020. Ironically, aerosols have a cooling effect in the atmosphere and had been helping to mask the true extent of the climate change until now. There was also a large eruption of the underwater Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'apai volcano in 2022. Volcanic eruptions that happen on land send up plumes of soot and aerosols, which block sunlight and temporarily cool the atmosphere. But because this volcano was submerged under the Pacific Ocean, its eruption also sprayed millions of tons of water vapor into the upper atmosphere. Water vapor is a powerful greenhouse gas. It was the most explosive eruption since Krakatoa, and usually the year after is when you see the impacts, says Sean Burkell, an assistant professor at the University of Maine Climate Change Institute, who created a climate data visualization tool called Climate Reanalyzer. He suspects the warming effect of the volcanic eruption has been larger than early estimates suggested, noting that the eruption could have affected atmospheric circulation and helped amplify the El Niño that developed in 2023. But he added, more research is needed. Dr. Schmidt pointed out when scientists put together their estimates so far of how much the volcanic eruption, the reduced shipping pollution, El Niño, and climate change should warm the planet, the numbers don't add up. There could be something still missing, he said, like other sources of aerosol pollution having improved more than the researchers know, or Earth's climate having more internal variability than expected, or global warming amplifying the effects of El Niño. Several groups of scientists are working to get a clearer picture, Dr. Schmidt said, and he expects the results to start being published in the next few months. And that's all the time we have for today. This has been Rick Anderson reading selected stories from the April 10th, 2024 edition of the New York Times Science section. Hey, thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed it, and let's do this again next week.